Good evening, New Jersey. Good evening, America. Welcome to... What show is this again?
That's great.
Vision Quest.
Welcome to Vision Quest. And we have a great big audience here tonight. And we have a very interesting subject tonight and some very distinguished people. Co-hosting with me tonight is Allison Sahu from City of Angels.
Hello.
And our special guests tonight are the Reverend Joel Jakubowski, Director of Community Outreach for Team Challenge, and his wife, Angie Jakubowski, President, and we'll let her tell you what she is in a few minutes, okay? So tonight we're going to be talking about addictions, we're going to be talking about intervention, and we're going to be talking about effectiveness of intervention and whatever else comes up in the next hour or so. So, with that, let me get started with addictions. There are many different models and theories of addictions. There's the psychological model, the psychoanalytic model. I'll start with Reverend Joel.
Yes, sir.
What kind of model of addiction do you use?
Well, thanks, first of all, Harvey, for allowing us this opportunity. We're honored to be here. Coming from the organization I work for, Teen Challenge, we approach addiction from a faith-based perspective. We believe that we have to be working on the character content of an individual, getting a person to understand that regardless of what has led that person into addiction, that every person is called by God to have a purpose and a plan, and God has that for each individual. And what we often discover is through the history of addiction, certainly what we break it down to is how that person is coping with the trials, the conflicts, the difficulties that we all experience with life. Mm-hmm. And we find that from a faith-based perspective and understanding that we have a God who loves us and has a plan for our lives, it helps us to reacclimate ourselves to our position on the planet. Who are we? What are we here designed to do? It generates from that person a necessity and a desire for being able to get to a place of disclosure, to examine the root issues that may have led to some of these things. That comes in many forms of hardship and things like this.
Yeah, let's talk about root issues for a minute. So I've read a bit of stuff on addiction, and some of the things we talk about are the addictive personality disorder, mm-hmm. or the addictive personality. I'm not sure exactly what that comes from. And there are all kinds of explanations, everything from, you're messing with your neurotransmitters, and the more you have, the more you need, and then you become addicted, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the psychosocial model, where you lack coping mechanisms, or mm-hmm. you've had trauma in your life, and you're using this, again, as sort of as medication, whether it be alcohol, drugs, whatever. So I guess my next question is, to what extent do you get involved in the underlying issues involving addiction?
Let me answer that from treatment center side, which is what Teen Challenge would be classified as.
And actually, before you even answer that, why don't you just give us a little introduction. What is Teen Challenge?
Okay, Teen Challenge is a faith-based drug and alcohol program, long-term, meaning it's 14 months long. We are a nonprofit organization. We are also state-licensed. We are the largest and most successful organization of our kind in this country and in the world. We're in 95 countries. We have 1,000 centers overseas, 300 in this country. We've been in operation as a nonprofit faith-based ministry slash rehab for the last 55 years, and we follow a modified 12-step principle of character building in the same way the 12-step does, but we return the higher power essence back to God of the Bible. And the most important thing to understand, as my wife Angie has nudged me, which I appreciate her, is that often the name Teen Challenge, meaning teenager, gives the impression that all of our centers are for teens. We began for teens in the 1950s, and there was great acclaim for the success, so it became a brand. But my division of Teen Challenge, which is the Rarsburg, Pennsylvania Teen Challenge, the mm-hmm. Northeast Division, is exclusively adult, and we are primarily male. Adult, and we have one women's center, adult center in Philadelphia.
And, okay, so it's actually Teen Challenge.
Correct.
Okay, and I always thought it was Team Challenge.
Yeah, a common error.
Because it's you're working with a team.
Yeah, right, yeah, absolutely.
So it wouldn't necessarily be a wrong name.
Yeah, especially when you hear it's adult, you're not going to go to team.
Yeah, sure. So therein lies the confusion. Yeah. Yeah. So you do have treatment centers for adults?
We do.
Which you primarily work with?
Yes, sir.
And you're working out of where? Lancaster?
Yes, I'm the director of Lancaster Teen Challenge, which is one of the divisions under the headship, part of the footprint. We have five divisions underneath the headship in Rarsburg that act as the first 4 months of the center, which is the first phase. And then we graduate the men to our second phase, which is our headship, which is the training center.
Okay. So you're working with men, and there's also a women's division?
Yes, sir.
Out of Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia. They have a year-long program that they do on one site, split up in two forms of curriculum and academic and operation, split at the six-month point. So they stay in one location, but it's still two phases.
Okay. So let's get back to the earlier question on the model of addiction.
Yeah, again, I kind of spoke to a little bit I'll let Angie speak to you from kind of the family way we approach bringing resolve, because we understand that addiction mm-hmm. is much more than an individual affliction. It is absolutely a family issue. So from the treatment perspective, to somewhat repeat myself, again, we believe that we can approach the addiction by giving a person an opportunity to reevaluate their coping mechanisms, reevaluate their character issues, reevaluate the root issues in their lives, and discover if there has been some hurts and harms and hang-ups that may have led to this coping mechanism, getting an individual to recognize then beyond just the act of sobriety that there's something more, there's something larger, that perhaps to some degree the addiction is now going to motivate that individual to start thinking forward and thinking, okay, I'm coming from underground of my addiction to the level ground of Teen Challenge. My hope is to be released to higher ground as a result of this learning, as a result of this character building, and, of course, being faith-based, as a result of a personal relationship with God, mm-hmm. and then tethered to that, the purpose that God has for that individual.
Okay, yeah. So...
And that's the individual perspective, and then Angie can talk to you more about how they approach it family.
And I'd be happy to do that. But just to backtrack, one of the questions you had asked was, how does Teen Challenge get to those root issues?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. in the curriculum, there is a counseling piece mm-hmm. and a group counseling piece that are very vital to dealing with those root issues.
Yeah, throughout the program, for the entire 14 mm-hmm. months, you're in group and one-on-one.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any psychologists on staff?
No. Everyone that's working for Teen Challenge is either certified as a counselor through the Pennsylvania Certification Board, or they are certified through the governing headship that covers all state-licensed facility, which is called the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. So they're qualified through their conditions.
Right. And you're taking people from basically all over the country, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Should we say the world?
Yeah, it really does become the world. We actually have a young man right now at our training center that went through our Buffalo division who's from Russia and had just come to this country and moved to Manhattan, New York, and fell into all the things that are in Manhattan, New York. And he's just really right now working through the English language. And so it's pretty remarkable. And as you said, our division tends to draw more Chicago East, because there's a lot of large centers that begin from Chicago out, and even Florida area has some large training centers.
So addiction statistics, United States.
Yeah, 37 million addicts in our country, and that includes not just chemical but process addiction. That has increased over the last 5 years substantially, and it shows a continuum of increasing. 22 million, almost 23 million chemical addicts in this country, alcohol, drugs and alcohol. Right. Angie will be quick to tell you that one out of three families is experiencing addiction in this country. Mm-hmm. These are government statistics. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And your success rate compared to other programs?
Yeah, it's always such a thrill to be able to speak to that. We have done 3 independent studies over the last 30 years, 2 university, 1 government white paper, which are on the footnotes of our brochure. We have a 78% success rate as our average. That includes the criteria of not just sobriety, which is one of them. We do studies with our graduates 5 to 7 years after they've graduated, and we measure whether they have remained drug-free. They're free from criminal activity, because some men are definitely experiencing the ramifications of poor legal decisions. And are active members of their community and giving back to their community and are maintaining, restoring, or cultivating healthy relationships. These are our criteria.
Okay, so how does your program differ from other programs in terms of that 78% number? Mm-hmm.
Certainly there's 2 things that we would attribute to it. We believe that our quote-unquote therapeutic model, which is really understanding a relationship with God, I mean, that's really a core, the faith-based aspect. Secondly, the long-term nature of the program.
Okay, but there are, of course, other faith-based programs.
Yeah.
And I would venture to guess they don't have that 78% that you have.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I will tell you this. I can't make an accurate statement to where we compare with some of the other programs, but I will tell you this. Governmentally, the 3-pack that I've researched where the government and its researchers' evidence-based practices, they all come to the same conclusion. They believe that the highest chance of success for addiction in this country is the combination of long-term, residential, faith-based. That's the 3-pack. Teen Challenge, being founded in 1958, have got a handle on that probably with longevity, longer than most. There are 1 or 2 other organizations that are also faith-based that approached addiction in the way we did around that time. But we have been the ones that have been really the pioneers, the movers, the shakers, and the developers of that model. And so we have an advantage of longevity, experience, troubleshooting. And I believe what we do really exceptionally well.
So where do you get your referrals from?
A variety of different places, other treatment centers. Sometimes they identify individuals that are expressing an interest in having a higher power that's more biblically related, more God-oriented. They realize this guy has been through their program other times maybe, and that our program is a good meet for that person. The legal system. I do inmate presentations throughout Pennsylvania. I rotate about 15 different prisons, and I inspire interest in our inmates. And then they go through their chaplain, and we do phone interviews to get them into our process. In the last 18 months, we've added to our population 50 or 60 inmates that came out of the legal system. We also get referrals through just community agencies, schools, churches. Am I missing any, Angie? What are some of the ones I should be thinking about?
I think you
just
got them.
Yeah, and even just intervention services like Angie provides, which is really something that is an important thing to understand. That one of the things that makes Teen Challenge has helped us to become more successful is integrating a real family-focused element to our program and understanding that we really need to be working with the families. And Angie's organization, Restorative Interventions, is our wellness partner. We believe in the model that she uses for intervention, which I know she'll share with you.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in just one second,
great.
Actually. So let me start with this. There's a psychological model that sees mental disorders as the cause of addiction. Mm-hmm. And such disorders as cognitive difficulties, mood disturbances, bipolar. Mm-hmm. Bipolar people are known to be more addicted. Schizophrenia, of course. Other mental illnesses. Are you getting involved in those kinds of things? Treatment of those kinds of things?
With intervention? Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
It's called dual diagnosis or comorbid. Mm. They go hand in hand. And people that are dealing with depression or anxiety are often also drinking or using drugs to regulate. And so really you have to get to a place where you find out what's real and what's the addiction. And absolutely, yeah, we work with that with families often.
Now, I've always looked at addiction as being the symptom, not the sickness.
Oh, that's good.
Although it can take on a sickness of its own.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is a secondary sickness. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like what comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
No, I think that's great. I like that analogy. What we try to explain to it seems to be the experience that we see more often than not, very categorically, at Teen Challenge, is that it was really an unfulfillment. On whatever level, we could look at that from hundreds of different angles. But it was a level of unfulfillment for most of these men that led to the addiction. The impression is that I came to Teen Challenge or treatment because the addiction created my unfulfillment. There was a level of unfulfillment that pre-existed.
Sure.
And the addiction simply exacerbated it to a point at which it was no longer able to be avoided or coped with.
Right. So the alcohol or the drugs are taken medicinally to make somebody feel better.
Yeah.
And then they start to feel better and they like it.
Oh, yeah.
So then they're going to take more of it.
Yes, absolutely.
And more of it. And then before you know it, it's their life.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's really how you can look at it. You know, the thing that's really helpful when you're dealing with addicted individuals is really just keeping it as relative and real to what it is. 40% of the Teen Challenge staff are graduates. That's also an indicator of our success.
Yeah.
I being one of them. I'm a graduate from 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And that program completely changed my life after several experiences through the short term and otherwise secular programs, which there's certainly a value in those programs.
Absolutely.
But it's just not for everyone. Some people need a greater level of care. But to answer your question, some of the way we keep it real for these men in the program is we explain to them, one way or another, whether even you're calling yourself an addict, maybe you don't even like the word addict. For now, we can look past that. But what we all have to agree on is the decision-making process that you were making in your life was not producing for you the fulfillment, prosperity, or abundance that you desired. There's a wonderful analogy or way to understand even just something as simple as low self-esteem. It basically says, who I am is not who I think I should be.
Mm-hmm.
Where I am is not where I think I should be. Cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like this. Emotional dysregulation. The scales are going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
One way or another, I experienced when I smoked a little marijuana as a young boy, personally, that emotional regulation hit a flat line. Exactly what you said, Harvey. It felt good. And there's no denying that it feels good. The problem is that we believe what feels good, do more of. And if addiction did not have cost, well, most of us would be using because it feels good. It releases neurotransmitters that say, yay, let's party.
Yes, those neurotransmitters.
Yes. The reason that most of us recognize the boundary and the necessity for the boundary, or at least drink responsibly, is that it has cost. If it didn't have cost, we'd all be going for a ride.
Well, it has a lot of cost,
not to mention
the substances themselves.
Absolutely.
But then there's the cost in lost time at work, lost relationships, families broken up, I mean, all kinds of things.
Yeah, every domain.
Yeah.
Every domain. Soul sickness. Every domain.
And I like that, soul sickness.
Yeah, it's the best definition that I know of. From, and I think it can go to both a clinical perspective. It's another good word for what maybe a more straight line clinician would call brain disease, which I'm okay with. I like soul sickness because I believe that the core of an individual is who they are in their soul, the essence of the individual. When the essence, the core of the individual is infected, the hands of the individual will infect every domain of his life.
That's very well put. I really like that.
So how do you deal with that soul sickness? How do you deal with the underlying lack of fulfillment?
Yeah. You know, and it might sound obvious, and it probably would be me having to repeat it. We just truly believe, and you know, it's so funny. I would just say look to the statistics. But just interpersonally, I would tell you that it really is establishing a personal relationship with God. Developing, if that's maybe too strong of an aspect, getting to a place where we really are walking by faith and less reliant on the microscopic evidence of my eyes, limited to the microscope, one eye only seeing this small petri dish of life while the other one is closed.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you look through a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
A person who has a faith-based structure, there's a wonderful thing that says in the faith-based formula, a naturally minded man, an evidence-based man, first he sees and then he believes. A spiritually minded person, not man, but person, first they believe and then they see.
Yes.
I don't know how that formula works. I've read the Bible several times and that formula is not spelled out perfectly. I know the source of it, but the formula God's going to have to give me in heaven.
Yeah,
but that's how it works. And there's something amazing that happens for an individual when they're willing to start looking a little further than the microscope.
When I believe it, I'll see it.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, law of attraction works that way, too.
Yeah,
you can, we've had several people on that here.
Certainly. Yeah, it can cross over to other schools of thought, for sure. We believe it comes in essence and in origin, is the best way to put it, through God of the Bible. And again, you know, the success of our program, even governmentally proven, speaks to it. It's remarkable. It's kind of hard to deny, you know.
Well, so when people come to you, do you find that they already do have a belief?
Yeah,
are
that's
they
a great
believers?
Question.
Or do
yeah.
they come to you kind of as a place of last resort?
Yeah, great question. We have a variety of categories of individuals that come. Some are just the homeless man who's just walking the streets randomly, or woman, that's really without any direction, really without any covering of care from any loved ones. Then you have another category that's growing up in what would just be kind of a standard American home, where maybe mom and dad both work, meals are getting a little less often between the family. He starts to experiment with his friends or whatever, that category. That's your after-school special. Then you have the category you're describing. We have individuals that have grown up in the church their entire lives, begin to, for whatever reason, experience a difficulty because life has conflict. And regardless of what influence they were getting, they took a chance on the fact that maybe this thing will provide for me something that maybe I'm not getting instantly through these other routes. Mm-hmm. And that can come in many forms, peer pressure and otherwise. And then the other category are professionals. We have individuals that come from what otherwise looked like a wonderful home. They had all the collective items that, according to the bumper sticker, you win if you get to heaven with first. And, you know, the home, the family, the nice car.
But and they're then, addicted.
Yes.
Maybe they have too much.
Right. And so now we get into what you were talking about, Harvey. Where does all of a sudden this come from? Sometimes it's a hardship. Sometimes it can be resorted back to something that's come down through the generations. I know Angela will speak to that. It can sometimes be part of what we, and it's the concept of addictive personality is very broad, and there's so many ways to look at that. Craig Nakin has probably the best book on it. If you're going to study addiction, you got to read Craig Nakin's The Addictive Personality Theory, and he really breaks it down well, and he gives you many views. But the addictive personality, a person who just has a tendency to some of the things that are core to addiction would be impulsivity, compulsivity, obsessive, going over the top with things, running things beyond their four seasons into a fifth, sixth, and seventh season, thinking you're going to tap one more drop out of it.
Is that something somebody's born with, or is that something that's acquired?
Evidence would suggest from both a clinical and biological standpoint that there seems to be some indicators that you can be born with it. Some would disagree. From a spiritual perspective, we also understand that sometimes things come down through the generation of the families.
Right.
And I've even heard clinicians totally on board with that. They understand that sometimes the damage of families, the mental illness, the, you know, for our purposes, we would say this, the sin issues, the atrocities that occur in families tends to run down through the family.
Yeah, there's no question that mental illness is passed down through families.
Yeah.
We've seen that over and over again, in particular schizophrenia and bipolar.
Yeah, certainly.
And they're quite prevalent out there these days, although there's much more, of course.
Absolutely.
You know, it seems to me that sometimes when people have gone through the ringer, so to speak, and when they've reached the bottom and there's nowhere else to go, they look up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, I know, Angie. Why don't you share with them? Sometimes we work with families, and Angie will tell you, we don't classify who we'll work with. We don't care what your background is,
right.
Whether you're faith-based, whether you could be a Satanist. You need help, we'll come and meet your needs.
Yeah.
And Angie will tell you, tell them about how sometimes, you know, when we come in and we start talking about these things, how people's eyes and ears start opening up. Isn't that your experience? So people start becoming,
absolutely.
Like you said, Harvey, they're at these breaking points where suddenly the idea of maybe reaching for something a little larger is not so far away. Even the billboards for like the Army right now, if you look on the highway, says, come join something larger than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting
that,
appeal. But and talk about, is there any of that you would like to add to, Angie, as far as what you've seen?
Really, you know... I just kind of think when you said when you hit the bottom, with that thought, I immediately go to intervention being raising the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
And
I like that.
With the model of intervention is a rise that I practice. And It is a family and invitational model of intervention. And so we use the resilience that we pull from a genogram that shows the history of the family, the secrets of the family, the stories of the family begin to come out. And we work on those strengths and that resilience to motivate the change in the addicted loved one. And there's no longer secrets. There's no longer isolation. Like, you know, I'm telling you one thing, I'm telling you one thing. And, you know, and through that coming together and the family meetings we have, it's amazing to see how the person is motivated for change and doesn't have to hit that bottom. It's a beautiful thing.
Doesn't have to hit the bottom, or if they have, you're going to raise them.
That's right. Yeah. That's for sure. And many of them have hit many bottoms, and they're back up somewhere, you know, and they're just up and down.
Yeah, that, well, that's a great point. The bottoms are undefinable and unlimited.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable thing.
And they tend to be a little bit cyclical.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. Yeah, more often than not, actually.
Sure.
Yeah.
At least until you get a final, what's the word? Final cure.
Yeah, so to speak, yeah.
Solution.
Final solution.
Yeah, solution. Resolve.
Yeah.
And it takes the whole family. The ARISE method isn't just about getting that resistant loved one into treatment, although that's the primary function, because that's the sickest member that it's important. It's a life or death situation. But it then goes on to a continuum of care with the family members to relearn how to do life and learn about addiction and those sorts of things. So when dad, for instance, comes home, a new man in his heart and mind, the family is now on board also, and they have done their recovery.
Okay, so I was going to ask you if you're doing family therapy or something like that as well.
It's not family therapy, but it's a continuum of care. Once we get that addicted loved one into some form of treatment, and we meet them where they are, we start where they're willing to start, and there's three levels or phases of the ARISE model, and we only rise to the level needed based on the resistance of that addicted loved one. And more often than not, we have that person in some form of treatment within the first few weeks, which is an amazing thing. It's amazing. It's evidence-based. It's a wonderful model of intervention. And I believe the statistic is about 95% success rate of getting a resistant loved one into treatment. Most of that happens within the first two levels. Mm-hmm. And then a very small percentage, maybe 3-5%, have to go to that third and final level, which models a little bit of what you see on TV with the letter writing and that sort of thing. But there's no bombardment. There's no attacking the addicted loved one. They're well aware of the model and the method and what's going to happen next. So it's really a very effective model of intervention, and it addresses the whole family. And it's about everybody getting into recovery and
makes sense.
Getting support.
Yeah, so important. Yeah. That's really what the benefit has been for us partnering with Restorative Interventions, Angie's organization, is it's really allowed us to subcontract out these kinds of resources to meet the needs of families, because we're getting a lot of the understanding, even from our students, of the unhealthy nature of their family. And so Restorative Intervention also provides wellness programs, some of which I'll even facilitate. And it educates the family. It gets them on board, empowered, educated, understood, reduces stigma. People start talking. That's a large part I know Angie will share with you, is getting almost advocating for addiction to get families to understand, listen, 37 million addicts in this country, you're not alone. Let's get the hand off the mouths and let's start disempowering this thing by talking about it.
Empowerment.
Yeah, huge component. And that's what her program does. It really does. It gets those families.
So you're not Team Challenge. You're a separate organization.
Yes. She's
a partner.
I'm a partnering organization of Team Challenge.
Okay.
Sure. And those educational programs, I just wanted to add, they're done in churches, in public arenas, so that the whole community is becoming educated on addiction. And that's it's a powerful presentation also.
Okay, so recidivism, 3 months, 6 months, what do you think?
Where is it found most often?
Yeah.
And now when we're saying recidivism, are we talking specifically, and I think it is what you're saying, after a person graduates the program or leaves treatment? Mm. Because there's something different between...
Well, I'm backing up.
Yeah.
Somebody comes into treatment. Mm-hmm. Is there a point where you could say, yeah, they're doing well, as opposed to they're still kind of iffy?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Like Angie said, even as large of an organization we are, we have really created it to where we have a lot of the ability to be very specific to the specific needs of each individual. Every individual is constantly in a process of both one-on-one counseling and group counseling. There's also, within the curriculum of our academic structure, it also is speaking much in part to how to deal with the normal domains of life, like dealing with authority, healthy relationships, emotional regulation. But these are also all the conversations that are really happening, in essence, in the counseling. So we collectively, as a team, have what we call case consults, which a lot of organizations have, and we help to share what's the teacher experiencing with that individual? What are the questions being asked? How they answer the questions? And then, of course, let's look at it from a disciplinary factor. We don't kick anyone out of the program, but you can certainly, after enough time and a lot of time, you could disqualify yourself from the program by proving in your behavior that you're just completely obstinate and disengaged.
Which begs the question, why would you be there to begin with?
Yeah, it does. But, you know, we have a very open mind approach to addiction and to that life controlling issue. You know, there's a wonderful thing that Carl Rogers established, and it's called unconditional positive regard. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're familiar with it. It just means you're allowed to feel how you feel. And so we're not, even though we certainly have a value system that we're trying to expose you to, we're not demanding it. We understand that each individual is going to walk out something as large as a theology and a recovery in incremental, personal, and specific ways. And so we're not putting any, I mean, certainly we have rules of our program to maintain order, but other than that, there's no demands on the individual. We don't have locked doors. You can leave anytime you want. Our hope is that you'll stay. And being that 40% of our staff are graduates, being that, you know, if you really boil down, if somebody was to say to a person that's following the principles of God or the Bible or even Jesus, if you say, what's your religion? The religion is love. That's the religion. And
that's
so,
universal.
Yeah, it is. And so that's really what we are really trying to always express to the clients of our program we call students. We don't call them clients. They're not inmates. They're not patients. They're not clients. They're students. And so we're trying to explain to our students through this expression of love, which comes in both the shape of a lion and a lamb, judicial and grace-based. And we try to bring to them enough therapeutic resolve to inspire them to stay. But we understand you can leave if you want and understand we have some rules you got to follow.
Actually, I was wondering that myself. What kind of a dropout rate do you have?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. We have done more and more things along the way by changing around our academic curriculum has been one way we've tried to decrease dropout. There's evidence that suggests that a very formal orientation process, especially for a long-term program, increases retention. We've done that. The standard and most statistical dropout rate for any long-term center, 6 months or beyond, is anywhere from 50 to 60, sometimes 70% dropout, usually within the first couple of months of a long program. We have finally got to a place. I just did this study, actually, about 2 weeks ago, proudly to show our CEO, because we made a lot of changes. And we are now up to a 42% dropout rate for our long-term program.
That's
I don't know
bad.
If anybody can say that. That's a remarkable statistic when you know they understand how people drop off. You know, so we're pretty proud of that.
So what's it like day-to-day for one of your students?
Yeah. We follow a very regimented curriculum. In the first 4 months, it's much more boot camp of style, I guess you could say. Certainly not with anyone yelling at you the way a drill instructor would be, but it's very regimented. Basically, you're a little duck behind a big duck everywhere you go. What we're really trying to generate in that individual is to understand and to fall in love with self-discipline. The fact is, if a man is not self-disciplined or self-governed, or a woman, then society will do it. I would rather be a person that learns how to govern my own behaviors and not let that be the responsibility of another. Mm-hmm. I'll certainly be more graceful to myself, to say the least. And so we're trying to teach them in those 4 months a really good understanding of being regimented, being a person of order. They make their beds all the way through the program. Matter of fact, I still make my bed.
And I'm out of the program 10 years.
Structure, organization. Keep everything has a place. It's not neurotic. It's just keeping when the outside of your life has order, the inside of your life will tend to have order, and vice versa.
So if I'm understanding correctly, self-discipline is going to lead to a renewal of self-esteem.
Among several things, yes. How about just the idea, if I'm a person of self-discipline and I've really made me my favorite hobby, I'm going to be less susceptible then to the wiles and the temptations of the old people, places, and things, the old behaviors of some of the people that maybe are even in my family. I'm going to be a person of more resilience. I'm going to be walking on a value system that's a little bigger than how I feel about things. And that's a remarkable place to be because, you know, for most of us, when we really boil down our value system, we find to some end that there is an emotional loophole. That it's depending on what mood I'm in or what may be advantageous or correctional to me may slightly alter my value system. We don't operate that way. We believe that there's a value system that's bigger than us and that the balance of our emotions and our behaviors and our moods can be found within the context of that relational, keyword, relational value system. So what we're teaching our men is to not be so focused on being a person of self-discipline and being a person of order and being a law-abiding citizen because you fear loss. I obeyed the speed limit for the most part all month last month, and you know what did not come in the mail? An award or a prize, because that doesn't happen on the planet Earth. What only
you mean
happens,
there's no positive reinforcement?
Nope, thank you very much. There's the clinical term, exactly right. What there's a lot of is negative. And so if I break the law, so I obey the speed limit because the world teaches me that that's how I avoid pain and discomfort of the ticket. When we're getting into a faith-based perspective, a value system orientation, especially relational to something greater than myself, what we start to do is not live our life with such a fear of loss, but we live our life motivated by the anticipation of gain. And that's what these men and women are learning, that there is something to be gained relationally, spiritually, interpersonally, from being a person of that character and conduct. And I'm going to tell you what, Harvey, it's never failed me yet. And my wife will tell you the same thing. And so this is a large component. So the first four months of that, when they come to the training center, it's no longer that methodology. We believe that after 4 months, you're a person of self-discipline. We can now treat you with that assumption, which we evidence as being true. And now it's like a college campus. You're going to get a schedule. As soon as you show up, you will be moving through the entire program with the class of students that you came into the program with for the next 10 months. You're a first monther, a second monther, a third monther, and you will go through the process of structure, academic, vocational, outreach, privileges, visitation times. Those will increase as you go through the program, and you follow a college schedule, basically. You have a syllabus. You have to be to counseling at this time. You have to be to class at this time. And like any other place on the planet Earth, if we have to come find you, you're going to hear about it.
Are privileges earned?
Some are given, some are earned. Yeah, because there are certain privileges that can be increased but still have to be in place. We absolutely inspire the developmental restitution and restoration with family. So there's always phone calls, always letter writing, always visitation. After we believe a person is acclimated with the program, not so easily distracted by family, after a few weeks and then maybe a month, then that begins to greatly increase. You get so many phone calls a month, the minutes increase as you go through the program. Time off campus with your family increases. And just even weekend visits. We have marriage retreats that we offer married families where we put them up in a hotel for the entire weekend, cost to us, and we bring in specialists from around the country to educate these marriage couples on how to have an appropriate relationship, many of which don't know. They just don't understand it. When that, and I know Angie will tell you this about working with families, when that addicted loved one is no longer addicted, it's not always a relief to the spouse. The spouse has become very comfortable with the inconsistency of that individual, which has now become predictable.
That's kind of the devil you know.
Yes, great analogy. That's right. That's exactly right. And so there's not just learning that occurs through the process of recovery and the process of like what Angie's doing with these families. There's also something called unlearning. Can I unlearn that 2 + 2 = 4? No. Can I unlearn that 2 + 2 = 5? Yes, I can unlearn that. And there's so many character and relational things that have to be unlearned.
Well, so you're basically having people unlearn whatever views they've developed of the world, which we would call faulty.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, you learn when you're in a family with an addicted loved one what life looks like. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really look that way. Mm-hmm. And then when it changes, you don't know what you're looking at anymore.
And it's like, what do I do? It's different. It's normal.
Yeah.
I don't know how to handle it.
Right. And you've just become so attuned to the chaos
that
you're almost not okay with the stillness and the peace. And you really have to pursue your own recovery in that process. And I think a married couple needs immediately to be engaging in marital counseling.
Absolutely.
And groups to relearn what they look like, maybe for the first time ever, becoming healthy together.
So when we talk about marital counseling, what are we talking about specifically?
Well, I would just say a great therapist that works with families, that works with addiction, knows addiction. I don't provide that service. When I'm as an interventionist, I can't have that dual role, of course. But there are some really fantastic people that I know that I refer out to provide that in Pennsylvania.
All right, so this is another component of the program.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, connecting families to the resources that they need.
Right.
Angie, like as she was explaining, you know, she really comes in as an interventionist, as a guide.
Absolutely.
She is their tour guide, how to walk through this process to where resolve is found. Mm-hmm. Resolve is not found through the therapeutic things that she's providing, because that's not her role. Resolve is found by her ability to point you to the resources that she's identified specifically that you need husband, you need wife, some apart, some together.
Okay.
Some just for families, some just for the addict.
Mm-hmm.
What do the kids need? What do we need to start doing for these kids? What are some groups
they
need to start getting involved in? And then everyone commits to that and says, this is what I'm willing to do. And then you're approaching.
And then we continue to meet during that continuum of care. And I do provide psychoeducation on addiction. We talk about topics, for sure, about enabling and codependency, what it looks like to be healthy. We certainly discuss those things, but we don't go into a therapeutic avenue. Mm-hmm. And also, just coming together when there's no more secrets going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
There's no more isolation. The healing that begins right in the office, in those intervention family meetings, it's just priceless. It's for the first time people are communicating, and there's nothing unknown in that. There's, you know, Johnny can no longer deny that Johnny's borrowing money from mom, you know, in front of the family, and not paying a bill or borrowing the same amount of money from Joe. It's just everything is there, it's exposed, and it's dealt with and worked through. And it's just a really phenomenal process.
So, go ahead.
What kind of person do you find does best in that type of program? You know, there's so many different types of programs available for people with addictions, and many have very different approaches. What kind of person does best in a teen challenge type of a program? And what conversely, what kind of person does not do very well?
No, I think that's really a great question. Let me start by saying, in most long-term treatment centers, as it is with Teen Challenge, the average age is 37, which is already an indicator to answer your question. A person who has reached 37 who's entering our program, if we were to go to the 250 men that are at Teen Challenge at the training center, all collectively there, and we rounded them up and I asked everyone who had been to other programs to raise their hands, there will be all but maybe 3 guys there that have been to other programs, because those guys that have not been are only 18, because that's where our program starts. If I ask them who's been to 5 to 10 other centers, a third of them will keep their hands up. We have one young man who's 27 who's been to 13 long-term programs.
Yeah.
So there's an indicator. It's where people are recognizing, I've tried all the paths of least resistance.
Okay.
I was trying to find a simple solution for my complex problem and was unable to find it. And so I bounce off every one of these centers, and I want chocolate cake from the world. I want chocolate cake. But every time I go through one of these programs, we look in my mixing bowl, it's vanilla cake ingredients. And so they get tired of adding every time vanilla cake ingredients and expecting chocolate cake. If they don't get tired of it, Angie will tell you, the family does. And so many of them are motivated by loved ones. Enough is enough. And whether they're doing it through intervention or not, they're hearing boundaries. They're also experiencing more pain. By the time I was 37, there was so much loss. Everything I went to Teen Challenge was at the age of 37 was either what my dad bought me to go to the program with, my toiletries, or my 4-pair underwear, 6 pairs of socks, and 1 pair of jeans and a gym bag. I was 37. I smoked crack cocaine. I smoked everything I owned, my relationships, my home, my job, my car. And so we're at such a level of brokenness. So the best candidate is usually a guy who's going to probably lock in more than the younger man is going to be a guy who has got to some end point. Okay. In also, though, another element now is the faith-based component. Some individuals understand already coming in that I just truly believe innately, for whatever reason, through my parents, through my own value system, my own experiences, that it's going to take God. I get it. Some of those guys already know just from reading about 12-step literature that, in essence, the first step of the 12-step model says that I have to find a spiritual awakening. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to find a spiritual awakening. I've been hearing about God a long time. I think I'll give him a whirl. And so they come in for the faith-based aspect. Real quickly, my father, who is one of Angie and I's biggest fans, has just sent me a text telling me that I should not forget to talk about the cost of Teen Challenge.
And I just got the same text.
So we thank you, Dad. We know you're out there, and we appreciate that support. That's right. The cost of the program is remarkable. The 14 months of Teen Challenge only cost $750, one-time fee for intake, and $250 through our administrative hub in Harrisburg to do the processing. So $1,000 covers the entire 14 months of our program. $750 only covers the 12-month Women's Center in Philly. You know, a lot of people say, that's just too good to be true. It's just good, and it's just true. Mm-hmm. We're donor-supported. One-third of our income comes from mom and pops, $20, $50, $100 a month for the last 50 years. Another comes through community organizations, churches, businesses. And then the other third comes from the money that we are able to raise vocationally by kind of acting as subcontractors. Our students actually do some production for international companies and national companies right on site, and we do some off-site work for national companies. Oh, I'm sorry. Some of the co-organizations that we are in partnership with, you may very well not know that you know. One is Michael's Foods. Michael's Foods, pretty much at any fast food restaurant, if you ever had an egg, whatever the egg meal was in the breakfast, that's Michael's Foods. They're one of our organizations. Kalis, the people who do the wire harnesses for Harley-Davidson motorcycles and other motorcycles. Tallman's Potatoes. And so that's a portion of our program. That is our work development program, where the guys start to get into the latter months, we start to get them prepared for the workforce. So these organizations will actually train them and certify them in soft skills, warehouse, shipping and procurement, forklift drivers. And when these guys are ready to graduate, these organizations, if they would like to have it, the student can be offered a full-time position. Some of these men are doing this at $18, $20 an hour as soon as they leave the program. Let's say the individual is working at the Tallman's Potatoes near our facility, but he does not live in that area. Tallman's will put them into their national database, see if there's a job for them at one of their other sites, and they'll get them a job closer to where they're trying to go. And that in itself has really helped to reduce whatever we would call as relapse or even recidivism. It's so holistic, the program.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that word.
Oh, it just covers every domain. We offer GEDs for our men. The state requires a 30% success rate. For the last 2 years, we've maintained 100%. We're soon going to become, our mission is to become an actual testing site. And so it's just I would suggest for your listeners, just go to Teen Challenge TC, which stands for trainingcenter.com, and it will give you the breakdown of what you can really expect from Teen Challenge.
I refer to Teen Challenge as a do-over.
Yeah, that's great.
I just feel like it allows a person to rebuild and redo life, and sometimes for the first time, finding out who they are. And it's just, it's miraculous what happens throughout that program.
Yeah. I came to Teen Challenge in 2003 with 20 years of cumulative addiction. And I had tried the other programs, the short-term programs, the outpatient specifically.
How did you feel about God?
Yeah, oh, the last thing on my mind with anything, God. Yeah.
Sure.
My gosh, man, are you kidding me? I was a 80s punk rocker with upside-down crosses on my shirt. Are you kidding me? I was so logic-ridden in the concept of pushing my chin up 4 inches to talk to what for me was Santa Claus in the sky. You can ask my father. I know he's listening. He's probably giggling because he
so was more like the Antichrist.
Oh yeah, I had, and then it really, Harvey. It's funny because it really got to a place that's even more interesting. Is I really just got to a place where I really just didn't give a darn. I really didn't care if there was God or not. Mm-hmm. So when I went to Teen Challenge, the 14 months when I went through, we were only 12 months. We added 2 months for that work development program I talked about. But the year, you know, hard to swallow, but a year of my life was going to pass whether I went to Teen Challenge or not. I was 37. I knew what the progressive end of addiction was, institutions, prisons, and death. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd already done institutions. Yeah. Prisons was just around the corner. So for me, it was the faith-based thing, like Angie said. Oh, my gosh. My sister told me that it was Christian-run, not Christian-owned, or Christian-owned and not Christian-run.
Right.
When I got there, the therapeutic model was God of the Bible. It was, man, it was exposure. But that was where the success was. And so, you know, at first it was very difficult. And I kind of just nodded and agreed. But, you know, some miraculous things started to happen for me. I started noticing that the individuals that were not as critical as I was, the ones that came in my opinion, some of them had a worse story than me, man, in their addiction. These guys were hardened up. Mm-hmm. And these guys were coming in and not playing any games, being everybody's critical observer, sticking to the wall. These guys were embracing the principles of the program. And they were taking a chance on praying and reading the Bible. And they were changing. They were changing. Their behaviors were changing. The conversations with their family at home were softer and more peaceable. Some of these men, they're literally, their walk changed. They came in hunched over with clenched fists, and now they're walking down the hall, square-chested, looking people in the eye and asking how their day was. I would challenge these guys left and right and say, what game are you playing?
That's self-esteem.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But where did it come from?
That's the key. Where did they find this self-esteem? And these guys would say to me, you know, I've been through 10 other programs, and this program is very different. I didn't think it would be. It is. And eventually I peeled myself off the wall and pushed that chin up 4 inches.
And, you know, I have to interrupt you for 1 second.
Yes, sir.
I had a conversation with an attorney here in Hamilton Township not too long ago on a drug case. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about Teen Challenge, in fact. And we were talking about other programs, and he says, you know what, rehab programs, none of them work, they're all BS. Everyone I've seen, the people are back on the streets again.
Yeah.
I said, you know what, not this one.
Yeah, not this one.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, when you keep in mind that we have a 78% success rate, here, I want to share with you what happened for me as a result of Teen Challenge.
Yeah, please.
That I was unable to acquire through the result of good advice, tools, and
yeah, let's have your personal experience.
Yeah, and the reason I want to share it for you is because I want you to keep in mind when I'm sharing this with you, I'm one of a 78% success rate, so I could line people up at the door that would share the same story.
Right.
That's what makes it so easy. I when I was in Teen Challenge, I felt led to understand the value of giving back, and I started.
I'm sorry, you know what? I just want to back up with
you. Yes, sir.
How did you become addicted to begin with?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was probably a series of different things. Probably one of the first things was the divorce of my parents, very young, mm-hmm. hard to understand.
Yeah.
My father chose to leave the home with my mother, and I think I really, especially at that age, really was very father-focused. I certainly had a wonderful relationship with my mother, mm-hmm. but, you know, a young boy really wants it. And my father was fairly consistent about coming back and cultivating as much as he could, but he realized that the marriage was coming to a place that was, from their perspective, unreconcilable. As it turned out, in time, not only had that become an issue for my sister and I, who was 4 years older than me, but then while we were living with my mother, she had succumbed to mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia.
Mm.
And she just went through an unbelievable negative metamorphosis where she really went inside of herself. Certainly you know some of the symptoms of schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of it was catatonia, where she would literally just be not talking, not bathing, mm-hmm. not sleeping for months on end. That was probably the most dramatic moment for my sister and I. I think what we learned is that really caregivers can't be trusted. and that we are going to have to raise each other, whatever that looks like. But that was not going to regulate that emotional dysregulation. Mm-hmm. Well, the truth be told, that I had some older cousins. This was the 70s, and pot was a big thing. And they got my sister to smoke pot, and then I smoked pot at the age of 8.
Which everybody says is mild and is nothing, and everybody does it.
Yeah, no. Statistically, it's definitely the front door to addiction. It just is. I know other people feel differently about it. I don't know one human being that's been through the recovery process that won't tell me that how they began was alcohol and marijuana.
I mean, I've argued a number of times in front of judges, but it's only pot.
Yeah, it's
not. And you can imagine the answer I got.
It's not. There's so many debilitating aspects of marijuana that we could go on. That would be a whole show in itself. But so anyway, so, you know, I think those hurts going unresolved, eventually I was able to get what you would consider a kind of a manageable life. I finally, my mother was admitted to the hospital and had to go under care. We moved back.
Who's taking care of you?
I went back with my father. We lived with his mother.
Well, I mean, before that?
It was her. Yeah.
So she was... She wasn't able to take care of herself, and she was taking care of you?
Yeah, and eventually it got to a place. For a little while, my sister and I attempted to kind of hide her to some aspect because we didn't want to lose her too.
Yeah.
And but it just became unbearable, and I think my father just was able to recognize it. He came in, saw her state, and I think we may have even told him. He would probably know better than I, but it's a long time ago. But
yeah.
So she was separated from my life. So at that point, it was really us now living back with my father, which was good. We had a semblance of a home again. My father was remarried. We moved to New Jersey. Right. But you see that seed of that discomfort and that disorientation and really a kind of a disenfranchising of what is going to be life. I don't think it ever really came out of me. And I think I started to realize, Harvey, at a very young age, that if having a nice house, a wife, and a nice car was the goal to life, you know, I knew then that wasn't going to be enough for me. I knew it. And I was already, I remember going to my father one point and saying, what if I'm just happy being a garbage man? You know, I started to examine, maybe I just got to find a place that feels good. Maybe it's not about the things. And eventually, by the time I was coming out of eighth grade, I was smoking pot 3 times a day in the woods behind our house. And and like anything, once you start to normalize the abnormal, it opens up the door for the next abnormal. Once I normalized the euphoric nature of marijuana, I said, you know what, I think I'll try whiskey. Then it went from whiskey to powder cocaine. And then one day some guy said, well, we ran out of powder, try this. And it was the rock form, crack cocaine. And when that happened, Harvey, all the other stuff fell off like old grapes on a vine. It was all about that drug. That drug did it all for me. Mm. And that became my drug of choice, and that took everything from my life. So, you know, why did I become addictive? Oh, my goodness. Who knows? Maybe it came down through the generations. Certainly in my family, as my father would share, we have some evidence of alcoholism, hardship. There might be some mental illness if we dig hard enough. And
so it's a whole variety of factors, psychosocial and other, hereditary.
It is.
A number of things.
Biopsychosocial. That was the word I was trying to think of earlier.
I thought it was.
Yeah, yeah, thank you, yeah. That's really what it is. Most clinicians agree that it's very hard for us to pinpoint one thing.
Yeah,
but we can certainly identify through the process of recovery, and I know Angie does it with her families, some real significant root issues. There are some real indicators of why you, for whatever reason you coped with medicine, I can see why you felt the need to cope and immediately. Because the emotional dysregulation of things like sexual abuse. When I counseled the men at Teen Challenge, that was the first thing. That's the other part of this that we should just follow through with.
Sure.
I graduated Teen Challenge. I got it. I got what it was calling of me. And I felt the led to go back to college, got my counseling degree, came back to Teen Challenge, worked through the ranks of intake, program director, and eventually was promoted to assistant counselor, and then eventually lead counselor of the center that I now run. I got my bachelor's degree in addictions and behavioral health, which Angie is just about to finish hers, which is exciting. It was so amazing when we met, how mutual we were. Yeah, we had so much in common that it was really neat when we met. But and so now I'm in a master's degree program. I have a book of poetry published. I'm married. I've only been married for 3 years. We own our own home.
You've got a life.
And a good life, and a really good life, and far more good internally than it has to be externally. That's the key.
Yeah. Right.
There's a peace that, you know, that the world couldn't provide me. It just couldn't.
Yeah.
And there's a knowing that's not a feeling, And there's just something very...
Happiness comes from within.
Right. And, but let's not get it confused. We didn't stop being human. Angie and I go through trials. We have a very real understanding of life. We're not walking around in a bubble with smiles saying, yay, yay, it's all better. Life can be tough, but we know who to go to over it, and that's where our faith comes in. And we're not miffed by life. We're not confused by conflict. We understand that it's designed to mold and shape us to become the individuals we were intended to be.
Okay.
We know there's a purpose for our life. And so... But I kind of forget what we were talking
about.
Well,
let's go back. So you know, I kind of digressed into, you know, how you became addicted to begin with. You gave us a feel for that. And you may have gone, I don't know the answer, you may have gone in and out of some rehabs.
I had, yeah.
And then ultimately, how did you come to Teen Challenge?
Yeah, right. I went through an outpatient program, and the truth is, I was ready. You know, I had drove all the way on a Thursday night to North Carolina, from North Carolina where I was living, where I would find myself some mornings going to work, finding a back cubicle, and just sitting there hunched over crying because my life was destroyed. I'd lost everything. My father had no real evidence of addiction, but he knew something was wrong. I had a full-time job, and I'm begging him for money left and right. It's not making sense. So I drove in the rain with my sunroof open and my Chrysler Sebring 9 hours in the rain, totally drenched to punish myself for whatever reason, totally depressed. Came in through the front door of my dad's house right here in Freehold, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And he was happy to see me, and I slowed down his joy and said, "Dad, I'm an addict." And I loved his response. I was so fearful. A son is always looking to some degree for the pride and approval of their father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly now I have Big Daddy in heaven. He's the one I really got to have it from. But it's always good to hear that your father has your approval.
Sure.
You have your father's approval. But my dad said a wonderful thing. He said, well, you know, at least we now know what to target. And I thought that was a good answer, and it energized me. Because it wasn't critical or judgmental, it was resolve-oriented.
Well, your dad is very good at focusing.
Yeah, yeah, he's solution-based, and I'm very solution-based. And so that's what we began to do. But, you know, my father, not having an understanding of where's the greatest level of success, we just started walking through what society offers. And I went through an outpatient program, and I was gung-ho. I was into it, and I was believing in it. They would come and sit on family meetings, and I really believed, okay, this is going to be the resolve. I didn't know the success rate of these programs. This is what you do. And I had about somewhere between 6 or 7 months of clean time, and I was doing great. But because, you see, there was no character change. There was no change to my values, attitudes, beliefs, or expectations. I was simply staying clean. It was all removal with no real replacement. I replaced it with meetings and an occasional call to a sponsor, but I really was not doing the things that needed to be done to become the person that I know I was intended to be. So there was a job being offered at a local restaurant on the main strip in Freehold,
mm-hmm.
as a bartender. I took it. It was a false sense of security. I didn't have the restraint or the forethought or the self-discipline to turn down the money for my well-being.
Right.
I think the job of life is to get a good job. I'm sober now. And it was not long after that till I was pouring red wine in my soda. And it's ironic because when that happened, after about doing that for a week, I was thumbing through the bartender's black book. And in that black book was a drink called Drunken Waiter. And it's where you add red wine to your soda. And I felt
everybody to know.
Heavens open and lightning strike my heart.
I just want everybody to know that is not a recommendation. Don't do this at home.
Yeah, certainly not a recommendation. That's right. Give great disclaimer. It started to slope all over again. And the truth is, I'll be honest with you, after having that time of sobriety and returning to the addiction, I've told this to people before, that return to addiction, the intensity and the amount I was using, because it's progressive whether you stop or not. That's why you have to put something between you and the addiction that's bigger than just a bunch of good advice. It has to be a relational and value system change, and I didn't. So that addiction was progressing and progressing. So when I picked up again, Harvey, it was as if I had been using all that time. I went back to a full-blown addiction that dropped about 30 pounds off me in a matter of 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
I was already going into debt again. I was writing bad checks, stealing my dad's car my sister's boyfriend's car, stealing money out of my father's drawer, out of my sister's purse. It went to a whole nother level. And my sister, to answer your question, came on the scene, and Teen Challenge had done a presentation in her church. And she went to them and said, my brother needs you. And that's where she very skillfully told me that it was a Christian-run organization.
And your
Christian-owned. Sorry, I keep blowing that.
And your reaction was?
Yeah, I was like, eh. And then she said it was Teen Challenge. I thought, teens? I'm not going to hang out with a bunch of teens. I'd be like an idiot there. And she said, no, it's for adults. And, you know, what did I have to lose? I wanted my family back. I wanted a life back. And the truth was, I was halfway through my life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to change on its own. And the next half of my life was probably going to be shortened. And so for me, it was lethal. You know, it was relational. It was lethal. And so I went to Teen Challenge. You know, I bit the bullet. They drove me to Newark, New Jersey, which was part of our division then. Now they go through New England. And did the 4 months in Newark, New Jersey on Brookdale Ave, which was the hood. Every form of my lifestyle was out the window. Drug dealing, prostitution, gangs, all the things I was exposed to before. And there I was sitting in this place trying to get the exact opposite behind the doors. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, I remember at one point hardly even believing in God, saying, well, if you're up there and you get me through this, I'm yours. You get me through this, where I smell my drug of choice being manufactured next door through the windows. If you can get me through this, then you're real. And lo and behold, as I've experienced, it was, you know. And so I made it and then went to the training center in Rarsburg, and everything began to change for me there. I started getting a new level of quote-unquote optimism, and certainly what was restored to me was hope, more than anything else. Hope.
I think hope is something we all need, and yeah. I think without hope, we have nothing.
I totally agree. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Hope is so inspirational, you know. Where you see the loss of life by one's own hand, you see the evidence of where that person believed there was no hope. Anybody that walks through the next anything to try to step one step further from their addiction, whatever the life-controlling issue is the evidence of some glint of hope in there. Mm-hmm. They're not even aware of it. But if you're not ending it, there's some evidence and some glint of self-preservation and hope. We'll work with it. I don't care if you come in with hope the size of a mustard seed. It can move mountains. Yeah. It will help to draw it out of you.
Yeah.
And that's well,
all you need is that one little scintilla.
Yeah.
And I was getting Tangie next.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you get involved in all this?
I got married.
you married into recovery.
But she was already pursuing behavioral health and addictions,
absolutely.
Which I thought was very interesting.
I was already plugging away at this degree, actually, in the behavioral and addictions counseling. But I come from a family with alcoholism and addiction. And so I was very, very aware of the reality of how that affects a family.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And just through a couple of different seasons and working with several different organizations, I found my calling, so to speak. And just in the middle of this last summer, I stepped into my own organization and have begun working with families and continuing on with intervention in the ARISE model. And it's just been a very symbiotic relationship, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
I do not only refer to Teen Challenge by any means.
Yeah.
And often we'll start with an intensive outpatient program.
Yeah,
we'll start wherever that addicted person and the family agree they can begin at.
Yeah.
And
sometimes they need detox.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Any treatment is better than no treatment.
That's right.
It just is.
That's right. And I provide three or four treatment recommendations, or at least options, and then one that I really recommend.
And once again, when you talk about the ARISE,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about rising from.
That's good. Yes. Yeah. But it's actually a model of intervention.
Yeah.
It was started by Dr. Judith Landau.
Okay.
And it is a three-level or phase intervention family process. It's invitational. So what we see on TV is that kind of surprise attack mode, you know, to the addicted individual.
Uh-huh.
And that is not the case with ARISE. From the very first call moving forward, everything is done with that addicted loved one in the mix, being heard and valued and... it's a respectful model that incorporates everybody's voice.
Okay. So let me get off drugs for a minute.
That's good. I like that framing. Got to get off drugs.
We're going to get off drugs. So there's drugs, there's alcohol. Just to branch out a little bit for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of addictions. And the way I like to put it is each and every one of us is fighting a battle every day. Mm. It's a battle we can't see, but still a battle within us.
Absolutely.
And some of them result in some kind of addiction.
Yeah.
Whether it be drugs, alcohol, gambling, sex, you name it. Shopping.
Yes. Yeah, we're all struggling
Facebook.
With something.
Facebook. Yeah. Computer. I mean, anything, yeah.
Yes.
Anything.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So what you guys are doing, is, are you just doing drugs or are you doing other things too?
Teen Challenge is specifically drugs and alcohol, because we're licensed as a drug and alcohol rehabilitation. But that's why we so much love partnering organizations like Angie's, because we get calls for people that have other very specific mm-hmm. life-controlling issues. Maybe it's sexual issues, maybe it's gambling. We won't necessarily turn an individual away, but we know what we do well, drugs and alcohol. So we know there's other individuals who that's their core competency. Mm-hmm. So we direct out to the people Absolutely. That just do that better than we do. And that can happen through just turning them over to Angie, who will then be that for them.
But if they have multiple addictions,
co-occurring,
with drugs being the primary and the comorbidity being other things.
Absolutely right.
And I would think that most people do have multiple addictions.
Yeah.
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is often, yeah.
And
often
there are many different types of facilities that do focus on dual issues for sure.
Yeah, and do it very well.
And the process addictions, you know, mm-hmm. the gambling, the shopping, those sorts of things. There's absolutely increase mm-hmm. even of these types of organizations.
And I would think, you know, that if you're treating people for their primary drug addiction, And you're doing all this holistic treatment and teaching that you're doing there, as people's self-esteem comes up, you're going to be able to, collaterally treat the other issues as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think Angie would agree. As any one area of a person's, let's just for the sake of this conversation, call them deficits.
Sure.
As that deficit is compensated, restored, refilled, it by default to some degree allows then for the other to be examined, dealt with, for that individual to own it. Because now you spoke on a very specific term. If I am experiencing hope and a higher level of self-esteem, I'm also getting to a place where I'm at a higher level of not just disclosure, but ownership. Mm-hmm. Once I've learned to own the issue, then I can courageously walk it through to resolve. And that's what the people like Angie and Teen Challenge are there to do, to help you walk it through to resolve.
If I said you were bringing people to higher consciousness, would that make sense?
Yeah, I think that fits.
To be self-conscious,
sure.
self-aware.
Yeah. I think it fits. I think that allows for both a practical view and a spiritual view. I think it's an easy fit.
Yeah.
Sure.
Let me jump over to Allison for a second.
Still here.
City of Angels.
City of Angels.
Tell us about COA.
COA.
What is COA?
COA.
City of Angels.
City.
COA.
COA.
Yeah.
What is
City of Angels. Well, City of Angels.
You guys live here?
It's tricky. I'm not home right now.
Almost, considering how much you're here, actually. Yeah. So City of Angels was started almost 5 years ago on the death of the overdose of the president of Hamilton's town council, Casey Mira. And what happened was, when Casey Mira died, his parents found that the heroin problem in Mercer County in New Jersey was a lot bigger than they thought it was, mm-hmm. because a lot of people started coming forward and saying that they had a similar problem. So City of Angels was started to help people who had this problem and who needed treatment. And it very soon grew into not only helping people with addictions get into treatment, but helping them maintain recovery, working with families so that they, as you very correctly mentioned, don't perpetuate those behaviors. And now the community really, it is a City of Angels, actually. Last year, we did more than 400 interventions and referrals to treatment.
That's amazing.
We worked with more than 600 families, and that's group counseling, support meetings. We have a family program. It's kind of a classroom, two-day-a-week program. Mm-hmm. We host more than a dozen, I'm thinking about 16 or 17 weekly meetings in our building here, and that's 12-step and other types of meetings. And some of those meetings address, aside from addiction and codependency, things like bullying, self-injury. We have some specialized 12-step programs like a veterans AA meeting. We have some recovery meetings for people who have gone to certain facilities. We have an alumni from the retreat, for example, where quite a few of our young people go. So it's a very comprehensive support structure that we have here. We also do recovery coach training. You may have noticed that the parking lot was full tonight, and that's because we're doing a week-long recovery coach. It's a 30-hour certification program that was developed by CCAR in Connecticut. You did that?
We just completed it.
Really?
Yeah, we're waiting to
Did you go to Connecticut?
No, we actually did. We were able to do the training site at Teen Challenge.
Oh, cool.
Through the Pennsylvania Certification Board.
Yeah, it's being offered all over the country.
So we have to test yet.
Well, one of the nice things about the City of Angels Recovery Coach program is that it is identical to the other programs, but we do it for half the price.
Oh, I like
so
that.
Everything that we do
but
here.
But you're outpatient, so to speak. I don't mean you personally.
Yeah.
I mean your program.
That's clever. That's clever.
Yeah.
That's very clever. Everything that we do here, we want to be of service. So we are not for profit. We're a 501c3. Everyone here is working pro bono. And everything that we do is free of charge, with the exception of the recovery coach, which is half the price of everyone else's recovery coach training. And 5 months ago in May, we launched City of Angels Recovery Radio. So this show, in addition to being broadcast on Hamilton Radio, our partner will also be rerun on City of Angels Recovery Radio. And we're really proud of it. We
a lot of exposure here.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. We have right now 8 weekly recovery shows, talk shows on Recovery Radio. And this Saturday, our newest show will launch. It's called Hope Fiend. Play on Dope Fiend.
Hope Fiend.
And I just listened to the first episode, and it's great. It's great.
That's
it's all great.
Great.
So, yeah, I'll send you guys the information. So that is City of Angels.
Okay.
That's great.
So if anybody wants to contact you, Jill,
yes,
or Angie or Allison, let me just go across the room.
Yeah.
Do you have an email or phone number you want to share?
The website you can go to, I said it earlier, it's just Teen Challenge TC, which stands for trainingcenter.com, teenchallengetc.com. You can go to my email, which is very simple. It's my first name, Joel, J-O-E-L. At Lancaster, just like the city, TC, which stands for teenchallenge.com. So Joel at LancasterTC.com. Or you can call me, 484-338-4886. Again, 484-338-4886. Call if you need.
And you can reach me at restorativeinterventions.com. Or the email would be restorativeinterventions@yahoo.com. Or you can call me at 717-329-0578. Again, it's 717-329-0578.
And City of Angels, our website is cityofangelsnj.
Like newjersey.org.
And our hotline is 609-910-4942.
Thank you. Well, folks, this has been a really interesting show. This is Harvey Rothman. This is Vision Quest, and we have been talking with Reverend Joel Jakubowski, Angie Jakubowski, and Allison Sahu. We've been talking about addictions, and we've been talking about intervention. We do know that addictions are massive in this country. We do know that New Jersey is one of the, what would we call it, Joel? One of the biggest
drug-induced states. that's a phrase, drug-induced state. It's
yes, that, which might explain some of our elections, but
yeah, that's great. Yes.
All due respect to the governor. Congratulations, Mr. Governor.
That's great.
On your re-election.
It's nationwide, but certainly New Jersey and its vast population is certainly affected.
Yeah. So this has been a really great show. I hope that everyone has gotten something out of this show and out of the information that our guests have provided today. Again, you've got all their contact information. And for anyone who is suffering from an issue, a challenge, an addiction, I would urge you to please get some help. Your life can be turned around. You don't have to go down this spiral to death and destruction. You can turn it around. You can have a better life.
Yes.
We have some people here that you can contact. Reach out. That's our show for tonight. Just a little preview for next week. We're going from addictions to something different. Next week, we will have as a guest here the doctor, Karen Whitefeather McCann, who is a holistic healer and a shaman. And Karen will be talking about her specialty and her organization called, if I remember correctly, I can't remember the name now. Sorry. But we will be talking about that next week. Okay. So have a good night, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.